from Social Service to SG, I'm Jingyang, co-hosting this episode with Samantha. In this wide-ranging conversation on community and community-based governance with Aaron Munyam, we cover many diverse but related topics. First, we discuss the global state of democratic governance in the context of community-based governance, as well as truth and misinformation. We then learn about his PhD dissertation comparing public sector digital transformation efforts before a segue into his evaluation of other tools, deliberative polling, panels, and citizen assemblies to facilitate community-based governance. Finally, Aaron shares his perspectives on Web3 platforms and dealing with diversity. Aaron is a Fellow of Practice and Director of Digital Transformation Education at the University of Oxford. He was also previously on the podcast exploring citizen foresight work and the influence of language and metaphors on futures thinking. So welcome back to the podcast, Aaron. You're not a stranger to this podcast and many of our listeners, though you're going through a recent career transition as well. So maybe tell us a little bit about that, right? So your previous work in government and where you're currently based right now in that transition phase.
Thanks for having me back, guys. It's great to be part of this lovely conversation again. So you know that I was working in government before, right? I started as a diplomat in the foreign ministry, did some work in strategy and futures in the prime minister's office. Taught a little bit about governance and policy issues at the Civil Service College before doing policy roles in the Ministry of Trade and Industry and then the Ministry of Comms and Info. That last job was particularly interesting because we were looking at digitalization and its pervasive impact on different parts of both the society and the economy. Right? So we were really thinking about how we grow the digital economy, but how we create opportunities in the digital society as well. And then how government itself can be a better user of digital. So in all of that, I think what I realized is my core interests are in what the role of government is vis-a-vis other sectors, right? Whether it's in technology or in the economy or society or the intersection of those. And I'm particularly interested in how governments function as complex entities, right? As systems of systems that are made up of complex subsystems. And I find that a particularly interesting question because there are lots of complex entities out there, universities, MNCs, and I'm really interested in how government, as a particularly large example of those, exemplifies both the challenges and opportunities that come from complex organization. So what I do now is I've joined the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford. So I'm still very much in the realm of public policy and the public sector. But I study and teach on issues of what government does and how it can do better a little bit more deeply. I'm building on the PhD that I did. And really, the big questions I'm trying to answer are how can government be a better user, better regulator, and better enabler of technology? Because I do focus on tech issues quite a bit. One interesting question, of course, is how you manage the tension between those roles as well. Right. What happens when the user, regulator, and enabler roles don't all pull in the same direction? How do governments make decisions? What data do they need? And how do they ensure that at the end of it, all public value is being created for citizens?
And so there's a lot of keywords I imagine we'll touch on, right? Previously, you talked about future citizen foresight work. You talked about digital technology and underlying this is the role of government, what it does, how it can do better. Right? And today, we kind of invited you because Sam and I were really interested in this topic about the future of the community and community-based governance, right? And maybe just to kind of get a lay of the land as well, I'd love for you to kind of share how you define or understand community. And I ask that question in the context of the fact that on this series, we recently did one with AMKFSC on community work and community development. So I want to know kind of from your perspective, how do you understand or define community in that sense?
Yeah, it's such an important question because you could have many different definitions and there are many levels at which community plays. For me, a lot of it boils down to community being distinct from the public and the private sectors, not just some residual third sector, right? But an actual sector in its own right, driven by different logics and really working with different currencies and resources. Eleanor Ostrom, the Nobel Prize winner in 2009, I think, differentiated between the state direction of the public sector, the market incentives of businesses and corporates, and communities, right? Communities which have a different logic, like I said, they are different, driven not by scale or optimization, but the desire, I think, to exemplify humanness in as rich a way as possible. Also, communities are driven by different logics, first of all. not scale that governments are often driven by, not optimization that the private sector is often driven by, but a desire, I think, to really create value for individual people, right, in their human complexity. But they also have a different currency, right? They don't work with policy. They don't work with the machinery that governments have. Neither do they work with the private sector levers, right? The creation of products and services. But they deal, I think, primarily with relationships, right? Communities leveraging relationships and social capital rather than power or money. And this means that you can have community playing itself out in groups, right? So community organizations, charities, religious organizations. And then you have individual citizens also, right? The fundamental component of communities. Sometimes the individual citizen is actually the most interesting unit of analysis. And both of those, I think, are critical. One thing that's worth saying, right, at this stage is that between the public, the private, and the community sectors, right? So between government, markets, and communities, I wouldn't say that any of them is inherently superior. If you look at each of them, each has a highest purpose that it serves, and each can have a dysfunctional or dark side as well. Governments at their best have scale, they achieve justice for a great many people, they have longevity as well because of what they do and the fact that it can last. But at their worst, governments are sluggish, slow, resistant to change. Right? Similar with private sector, right? Their highest purpose is to have agility and creativity. They try out new things, they innovate. But at their worst, they can be greedy, they can be avaricious, you know, they can be rent and profit seeking. And communities at their best kind of counter that, right? They are human, yeah. They're idealistic, they dream, but they also have a dark side, right? They can be dogmatic, they can be narrow, they mm-hmm. can focus on specific issues and not recognize that those issues have larger systemic ramifications. So I think it's really important to remember that none of these groups, right? Government, markets, and communities are inherently superior. And in fact, we need all of them in order for a society and an economy to thrive.
And so I agree with that notion, right? But I think the challenge of our times is not that they are not. So the idea is for them to be equal, but the risk is for the public and private to crowd out the community in that
Absolutely.
Sense, right? And yeah. what I like to kind of do and kind of almost like a thought experiment. Not, it's not from me, but when we think about the individual citizen, in your words, as a unit of analysis, think about community-based governance. I thought we could start with the extreme proposal, right? So there's a book I really like reading. I don't agree with it entirely, but it's a 2016 book. It's titled Against Elections, The Case for Democracy, Democracy. And it basically made a point in the book that instead of having elections, we should replace elections with lotteries and volunteerism, right? In terms of how we select political leaders. It's almost an extreme form of community-based governance where the people would, through lotteries and through volunteerism, rule themselves. And so it's a process called sortition, right? And the author kind of explains on our quote, he says, behold, the pathogenesis of our electoral fundamentalism. So what he says is that we draw lots, the most democratic of all political instruments, was used in the past before. It's a procedure that was not invested as a democratic instrument, but could bring about a new kind of way of thinking about bringing folks into positions of power, right? So if we use that as a starting point, what do you make of the state of democratic governance around the world right now? And how does community-based governance fit into that paradigm, right? So I'm leaving it up to you. You don't have to engage with the idea of sortition, but you know, how does community-based governance fit in our current democratic governance and paradigms right now?
It's a great question. It's a huge question, but a really good question, I think. And part of the reason I think that is, you know, if you look at that thought experiment itself, right, what exactly is the difference between an election and the kind of the random drawing lots and sortition? At the end of it, you still get a representative, right, who is through some process of legitimacy seen as an accountable representative of the rest of society. In one case, the accountability comes from randomness. In the other, it comes from the fact that other citizens have a voice and have exercised their voice and chosen them as representatives. I actually think in terms of substantive outcomes, they're not that different. The big difference is that in most cases, especially today, elections don't happen amongst multiple independent candidates who might end up being representative of a society. They happen through parties, right, which are these proxies of aggregating human interests. And very often when you have a party, I mean, that can achieve many positive things, right? Again, to go back to my earlier image, the highest purpose, right? Parties aggregate, they bring people together who are like-minded, and they represent what they see as legitimate human interests. But increasingly, I also think when in dysfunctional instances across the world, what you're seeing is parties forcing people to vote according to a particular whip position. So there isn't a huge amount of diversity once you end up in a particular party position. You can't agree with your opponents because that would be seen as betrayal, even if the complexity of the issues requires that. And I think that's one of the hard bits about that example, which when you think about it deeply, right, really forces us to ask ourselves, what is democracy even meant to do, right, in different countries? And I'm a big fan of the idea that actually democratic systems can be very varied in their manifestations and their modalities. I like the phrase that, you know, different countries are differently democratic. Now, this is not a relativistic argument, right? There are clearly undemocratic systems out there. Mm-hmm. But there are many systems that have different forms of democracy, right? The Indian form of democracy, the Singaporean model of democracy, what's happening at very local levels in China, that's very different from Anglo-Saxon democracy. But I'm not sure that any of them is more or less democratic than the others. They are just differently democratic. And this is why I think it's really important to ask ourselves, what aspects of democracy are we most interested in different systems? And I think you can identify a good number of them. I was thinking about this the other day, and I kind of boiled things down in my mind at least to five, right? Political outcomes. You want democratic political outcomes, and that is where you want representation of some form, right? Because not everything can be referendumed in terms of decision. And so we want some level of administrative ease, and the political outcome of representation is key for that. But there are also citizen outcomes, right? The delivery and the execution of day-to-day things, like I don't want potholes in front of my house. I would like the streetlights in front of my home to work. Those things can happen through a democratic system, but that's about delivery, right? And execution. It's not really about representation, although representation can help it to happen. But separately from that, you have democratic process and procedure, right? That might take the form of elections. It might take the form of citizen engagement, as we were discussing today. But those are different kinds of processes and procedures. And I think we need to really separate the procedural aspects from the outcome aspects, because you can have very democratic outcomes, even if your processes, right, are more directive and much less representative. But even that, I think, is not enough. If you read some of the work of more critical theorists, right, they will tell you that you also need democratic culture, instincts, habits of mind, that are very separate from procedural aspects. And this comes from education systems, it comes from democracies and town halls and discussions amongst parent support groups as schools of democracy, right? Mm-hmm. Ways in which we live out the democratic ideal and we build up that culture amongst ourselves as well as within our own minds. And that's very different from the procedural aspects. And I think we often forget this part, actually, together with the fifth aspect, which I like to call democratic language and vocabulary, right? Is it part of our lived reality or not, right? Do we live out democratic ideals in our families? Do we live it out amongst our friends, right? Or are some of us more dictatorial than others when we decide where to go for lunch? Things like that. I mean, in a way, it's a trivial example. But, you know, if someone is always making the decision of where to go eat, I mean, that's not a particularly democratic friend group, I would think. And the really interesting question for me, right, whether you're asking about sortition or elections or other modalities, is which of these aspects are we most interested in? Is it the outcomes at the political and citizen level, or is it the process, the culture, the language, and the vocabulary, right? The narrative of democracy? Because what was really interesting is that I'm not sure you can ever guarantee outcomes, right? Those are always going to be mediated by exigencies and circumstances. But the third, fourth, and fifth aspects, right? The process, the procedure, the culture, the language, those I think can be created or at least catalyzed and sustained by different sets of practices. But it's not always going to be elections. And even sortition is not enough, right? Yeah. Because sortition is going to give you some level of citizen outcome, quite possibly. But is it going to give you a process and a culture that is deeply democratic in its instincts and outcomes? I'm not so sure. And I think that's why I'm quite a fan of community-based governance, because you're really finding ways there to build up the muscles of each individual person, right? Their habits, their language, in a way that then complements process and procedure. If we were procedurally minded, right, we would only have elections once every few years and say, all right, we're all democratic, mm-hmm. right? There are scholars who will tell you that. Larry Diamond, in some of his earlier incarnations, would have told you that. I think he's got a much more nuanced view of democracy now, thankfully. But I think we need to therefore give some space to emphasize these softer human aspects of things as well, right? The culture, the instincts, the language, and the vocabulary. Because without those, elections become empty processes. Even sortition can become empty if we're not complementing sortition with this, you know, much deeper and richer sense of instinct building.
So I love kind of like the way you've broken down the different like components of democracy. And I think there is a lot of debate and discussion in the political science world on what makes like the best form of democracy, what's the truest form of democracy. So I'm kind of curious to know what happens when the different aspects are in tension with one another. So for example, like you talked about the representation aspect, So what happens if like more representation leads to less outcomes for the people? So like more representation means that people disagree on whether there should be a pothole, whether there should be a bus outside my house, a bus station outside my house. So like, can you really judge what the best democratic system is? Or how do we even start thinking about that, especially when the components start to kind of clash with one another?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think they like with most things in life, there will be tension, right, between these aims. And that's why I think it's really important to ask these questions, because if we assume that democracy is monodimensional, right, which some of the very, you know, proto versions of democratic theory did suggest, right, they focus a lot on representation or they focus a lot on voting, but not much else. I think you end up with a problem, right, because you end up with this very brittle, monodimensional and not particularly rich definition of things. And the key, of course, is to figure out how these things live in dynamic and constructive tension with each other, right? That at certain points, outcomes do indeed matter, right? But how you get to the outcomes matters too, because you might decide quickly what to do with things like a bus station and then realize that's not very durable because everybody's going to oppose you on it. And why is that the case? Because you don't have a sense of culture, instincts, habits of mind that need to accompany that overall decision. And this is not just about democracy as a tool, right? It's also about, if I live in a democracy, I do think one fundamental instinct needs to be that we believe that we are at least somewhat interacting with others, that our lives are intertwined and enmeshed with those of others, and therefore our outcomes affect them and theirs affect us. Whereas the decisions around things like bus stops and where you say, this can happen anywhere except in front of my house, that's actually a very undemocratic instinct, right? Or at least it's an instinct that doesn't demonstrate a huge amount of social awareness in what we're trying to do. So I think we need to find that tension and then figure out in what circumstances each of these aspects becomes important. We might decide, for instance, that on things like potholes, we don't need democracy at all, right? It's like, relevant agency out there, please just come and deal with the pothole. You don't need to vote about this. We don't need to have a long conversation about it. Nobody wants potholes, so let's just get rid of them, right? So there, actually, the machinery of the state can come in and be very powerful, right? Say, we will act on this because it leads to public value. But there may be other things that actually have larger ambiguities which require discussions amongst groups. And that's where you want to be able to actually convene a town hall discussion or some kind of council or consultative process whereby we understand better what individual groups are thinking. And you still may not have a perfect answer at that point, but you probably have a better answer because you've understood what the extremes of the overall sets of opinions are.
It's interesting because what you alluded to just now in terms of building muscles across those five aspects, political outcomes, citizen outcomes, democratic processes, procedures, democratic culture, and democratic language, right? That seems to suggest that we are not there yet, or rather it's an ideal, right? That we want to get to be differently democratic. And I want to get to a part of the conversation, and I think Sam will guide us through it in terms of talking about the potential of community-based governance, right? But if I could throw a wrench into this as well, this process seems to be complicated, and you also deal with digital technology, right? I remember a time when in the late 2000s, when they were like, social media and the internet is really a game changer in allowing countries to be more democratic because it opens up, it democratizes decision-making. You have references to the Arab Spring. You have references within Singapore as well. G2011 seems like a groundswell of things that came up, right? But since then, it's barely been 10, 15 years, the narrative has shifted, right? Now it's like, oh, having social media and digital technology seems to allow for the perpetuation of truth and misinformation, right? That it's increasingly more difficult to decide what is an objective notion of what truth or facts are, right? And you brought this to our attention, but how do we even have a discussion about community-based governance if we don't have an agreement over what is true or what's not, right? So maybe as a segue into something more optimistic, how do we then start to think about the role of digital technologies in this space vis-a-vis community-based governance and the idea of being differently democratic in those five aspects?
The thing about tech, right, is it is quite neutral. It's like any other tool. It can be used for highly positive, transformative purposes that you just described, right? Convening people better, connecting people who couldn't be connected, allowing creativity to flourish in a way that isn't always possible in the analog space. But it can also, as you pointed out, lead to highly pernicious outcomes. Misinformation, lack of truth, disinformation, willful blindness, echo chambers. Even if we all deal with pure truth, echo chambers end up causing partial truths to prevail rather than holistic, complex truths. And sometimes I think tech allows us to just kind of wallow in the comfort of these partial truths rather than staring at the abyss of complexity that's out there and being like, okay, this is really scary, but that is what I need to deal with, right? And so many political candidates in so many countries end up doing this, right? They reduce, they simplify, they turn us into facile infants because they know that's what's going to be attractive. And that's so dangerous because you end up, I think, distorting the richness, the nuance, the subtlety of what life is about. And am I an idealist? I am. I want us to try and understand these complexities much better. But I also recognize that in most societies, that is not the case, right? Because as I said to some friends once, complexity is not sexy, right? Neither is the truth, actually. The more complex it is. Simplicity is very sexy. And that's very dangerous for us. There's another aspect that I think is worth mentioning, by the way. So apart from the transformation versus misinformation kind of tension, there's another tension about tech, which is that there tends to be an implicit assumption in many quarters that tech is always going to transform. But I'm not sure it does. And a lot of my PhD actually was about how, when you look at how governments are transforming themselves, right, and their own agencies, digital technology empirically actually far more often ends up reinforcing and entrenching prevailing cultures, traditions, and practices rather than transforming them. So just as an example, right? People talk about AI these days, right? Everybody's talking about ChatGPT and bots. How is an agency going to use some of these bots, right? Do you use generative AI to say, okay, I create a bot. Everybody, please just key in your questions there and ask the bot the questions you would have asked a human, right? Useful, right? It's more efficient. It reduces the need for manpower. Individual humans can then manage a few different aspects of the bots and do more complex work. So it can be useful. But fundamentally, right, what is happening there is not changing the dynamic of the interaction with the state at all. It's still about people asking questions and some state structure, now a bot, not a person, giving that answer. A truly transformative system using AI would say, I'm going to use AI to trawl all the interactions that citizens have had with our service for the last X number of months or years. I'm going to track what new questions come in. And I'm going to keep refining our algorithm such that eventually we don't even need to have FAQs anymore because we understand needs so sophisticatedly. But in most instances, what you end up seeing is the first and not the second of those outcomes, right? A situation where you, like I said, tech reinforces what's already there rather than transforms. And in this instance, right, what I think you end up seeing in citizen participation is places that are already adept at using citizen participation processes or that already believe in its value, right? Because it complements the existing assumptions and mental models of the government and the private sector. They will use the tech in ways that enhance that. And for systems that don't believe in this, you will end up seeing tech that reinforces a hierarchical relationship with citizens rather than a more consultative one. So I don't know if this is positive or negative, but I have seen so many examples of this. And actually, there's a lot of empirical literature in the broader digitalization world, right? Not just on citizen participation, but on things like use of the social web by governments, development of skills and technical capacity in government technology agencies. And in all of those instances, what I've seen far more is tech as reinforcer rather than tech as transformer of existing systems.
Yeah, I definitely think it's really interesting how you talk about, like, there is so much hope and optimism that's put on technology, but people don't realize that, like, the fundamental fact that human behavior change is really hard. And tech might enable some of that, but at the same time, if you don't actually focus efforts on changing human behavior, the tech's not going to support it either.
Precisely, yeah.
But I am curious to know, because your PhD dissertation is on comparing public sector digital transformation across Estonia, New Zealand, and Singapore. Estonia is also the first country to institute electronic voting. So I'm curious to know how you think that this affects engagement in the electoral process from the community.
Yeah. So the PhD was not about community engagement specifically. It was looking at how tax and social sector agencies use digital to either transform or end up reinforcing prevailing norms. But there are lots of overlaps and adjacencies with the issues we're talking about today. And one very obvious one is that technology provides new online means for citizen discussion, citizen engagement processes to take place. And this became particularly important during the COVID-19 pandemic, right, where it just wasn't possible to meet. And it allowed, I think, discussions to happen in a continued way rather than just stopping entirely. So that, I think, was useful. even outside of a pandemic, it is very useful and more convenient sometimes for citizens to gather online rather than gather in a physical space. Right? You're probably going to get some increase of some types of participation for people who are already online and reasonably comfortable with things like Zoom and breakout groups. But you will also end up excluding certain groups, right? The ones who are not online or don't have access to an account. I've had people tell me, for instance, I don't have a Zoom account, so how do I play with all of this? You can participate, of course, if someone else has a Zoom account, but they may not always feel that they are enabled and empowered, or they may not have a space, right, to do an online meeting that's actually quiet. And so different people can be excluded for different reasons, I think. Where I find the most powerful examples of tech-enabling community participation happening, right, is where the tech is used to enhance rather than replace the in-person interactions. So, of course, when there's no other choice, people all gather two or three hours online, it's better than nothing. But where the outcomes are actually richest are where you already have existing relationships. People are maybe know each other, they're from the same precinct, they live in the same block of flats here in Singapore, and then they interact with each other online, which then enhances what is already there as a base of social capital. What can also happen nowadays outside the pandemic is you might organize a series of four engagements, say over four Saturdays. And instead of doing them all in person, you might say, all right, first one will be in person because then we can do icebreakers and get to know ourselves. The last one will be in person because that allows us to, you know, close things off in a more rich human way. But maybe session two might be done online. Right? So your burdens on individual time are much, much less onerous than before. So there are definitely lots of enabling effects, I think, that the tech can have. But I think it's important to remember that the tech should be used to augment rather than substitute for human interaction.
Yeah, just to switch gears a little bit, moving away from the tech and more focus on the community, because I love how you talk about the different forms of community within like a block of HDB flats or like just within your smaller groups of people who already know each other. So I'm wondering if you could share with us some successful examples of community-based governance for experience. Maybe one from Singapore, another one from Asia, another country in Asia, and maybe a final one anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I like that question a lot because you know, you do want to instantiate these things, these ideas, right, in specific examples. I think in Singapore, there's been a really interesting continuum of processes since around 2010, 2011, where we started what we call the Singapore Conversation earlier on. That was a very big process to really think about what the national future could look like and how individual lives would be part of that. That then spread out into multiple thematic focus on things like Singapore Conversation on housing, Singapore Conversation on national service, and other aspects of life. Later on, there was Singapore Secure, which was a citizen participation process on security and how we achieve more of that in a world where both traditional forms of security are under threat, but also new forms of tech are resulting in new digital threats. And then more recently, we had Singapore Together process, the Stronger Together process out of the COVID-19 pandemic, Forward Singapore, which Deputy Prime Minister Lawrence Wong has started part of his process of defining a national future. And all of those for me are examples where we want to involve citizens more as a government and find ways for that voice to be much better represented. Not just as an act of political theater, right? It's very easy to be cynical about processes like this. But I think what's really happening is an acknowledgement amongst my former government colleagues, I suppose, that they don't have all the answers. Neither do businesses, right? And we therefore want to hear about the lived reality, about the ethnographic, thick realities that citizens are going through in their lives. And that then helps to make better policy because it informs policymakers much more richly about what their users are going through. It's a very design thinking approach, if you like. Understand what your users are going through. So that's the Singapore example. Used very much, I think, to ensure that citizen mental models complement government mental models, right? And we end up with a richer understanding of citizen experiences. In the broader Asia Pacific, I really like some of the stuff that's going on in Australia. In Melbourne, there's a group called the New Democracy Foundation, there's a group called Democracy Co. in Adelaide. Both of which are really asking big questions around how do citizens get more involved in the aspects of their lives that affect them most. And you know, so some of their citizen juries have focused on issues like how to deal with stray animals. But they've also focused on issues like how much nuclear power do we want to have in our communities or close by to our communities. So these are not just trivial questions, right? They're very serious questions around what exactly people want in their lives. And a lot of the outcomes of these things are brought, say, to either decision-making bodies or government agencies or even local parliaments to be debated. And so this is not a guarantee that outcomes will be implemented, but it's a guarantee that outcomes will be heard in some way. Similarly, in the Singapore example, there's no guarantee that every policy recommendation brought up is going to get adopted. But there is a guarantee that the government is going to hear it because they are there at these sessions, and therefore these ideas are feeding into the consciousness and the understanding that individual policymakers might possess. A couple of other quick examples. I'm very fond of what's going on in the US as well. In Minnesota, there's a group called the Center for New Democratic Processes that's looking at a lot of city-based work, but not entirely. And there's a lot of that work focused on climate change and how, you know, transformations for sustainability can happen at local community levels. The Kettering Foundation in Dayton, Ohio is doing some interesting work on just broader deliberative democracy. There's a group called A Small Group in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is also trying to do city-level transformation, knowing that the city really needed, you know, a series of changes to revivify itself. And it's interesting to me that the examples in the US are nearly always city-based examples. Community work is very hard to do at a federal level in an enormous political space. There is, I think, a critical mass, a Dunbar number, if you like, of how many is the right number to involve in a citizen process. And in the US, at least, what strikes me is that cities seem to be the most active agents around some of this work happening.
I think all of that is super fascinating. I just have a follow-up question, because as the keynote minds were talking about it, like, it's so easy to become jaded in the process, right? Because one big thing, at least from what I'm hearing, is that community governance actually gets people more invested in the issues, more invested in the decisions, more invested in the outcome. When done well. So that is one of the goals. But when people become more invested, it also means that a lot of them want an outcome that's aligned to their interests, so what they've been thinking about, what they want. So when they don't see that, because it's hard, right? When you have representation, it also means you have more diversity of views. It also means that it's harder to find outcome that pleases everybody.
Yep.
And it's easy to get jaded if you don't get an outcome that's what you wanted, even though you've been so invested in the process. So how do you balance that? How do you ensure that people continue to remain invested, engaged, but understand that they can't get everything that they want and not get jaded by the process?
Great question. Three levels of this, I think, that are important. One is ensure that outcomes are as balanced as possible. And sometimes a really good heuristic for that is, does everybody get at least minorly irritated by the outcome, rather than one group being extremely frustrated with it? If your outcomes from citizen processes are always that 90% of the people are happy and 10% are unhappy, especially if it's the same 10% over and over again, then you end up with a problem. That is not probably a good, legitimate process. Balanced policy, actually, and I say this as, you know, kind of a policy nerd, right? Balanced policy actually should involve minor irritation for as many people as possible. Then you know you've got a good policy, which is seeking to achieve a relative amount of balance, right? So on things like housing in Singapore, right, on things like national service, everybody's minorly irritated with different aspects of it. But they know that this is probably the best they're going to get because life is complex and there are difficult systems out there to have to bring into play. So that's one aspect, I think. Having outcomes that are rigorously involve minor irritation for as many people as possible rather than major irritation for a small number. This might sound very counterintuitive, by the way, because you want to make people happy, right? You think in governments. But actually, I think in terms of what the right policy answer needs to look like, a little bit of irritation is not a bad thing. And then, of course, you need good communication, right? Explaining why small amounts of irritation is way better than large amounts and how this actually results in better balance. So that's one. Second, I think people need to be involved in the process. It's very easy to reject an outcome if you weren't part of the process. In fact, in organizational development, experts often say that people buy into what they help create, right? So even if I don't get what I want exactly, the fact that I was involved in it, that my views were heard, that there was a chance for me to get those outcomes met, that is important too. And I think in a lot of cases, if done well, that investment comes from the process and not just the product, right? It goes back to what I said earlier about the types and levels of democracy. I might be irritated with an outcome, but I can still believe that the process and therefore the culture, the language that was used was inherently democratic, and I still can feel validated and valued, right, in that whole process. So that's another level. And the third level is, if everybody at some point has something they're going to be unhappy with, that becomes an easier outcome for people to accept, I think, because they know that there's nothing structurally advantaging them. And part of this, right, is about just going through what I like to call the school of democracy, right, and learning that part of life is about not always getting what you want and realizing that actually it's very hard to define what you want. I have a great story for you on this. So in one of the early Singapore conversation processes, which I was very involved in, right, helped design some of the facilitation processes for those. This middle-aged woman stood up in the middle of it and said, oh, I just want to say something, right? And we're all like, oh, okay, where's this going to go, right? And then she said, I don't know how you guys do it in government. She says, I, on housing, cannot even decide what I want, right? As a homeowner, right, my husband and I want our flat to appreciate. We want the value to increase. We want we want basically an appreciation so that our asset grows in value. And as we get older, we know we have a valuable thing on our hands. And then she laughed and said, but you know, as a mother of a 24-year-old son, I really want prices to be as low as possible so that he'll like go and buy his own home and get out of my face, right? And it was really funny. Because then she said, I can't even decide what I want to do. And she said, I don't know how you all can make decisions based on, you know, the needs of multiple people, maybe each of whom has complex needs that are in tension with each other. And then we all had a good laugh after that. And a few of us said, oh, yeah, welcome to our world, right? This is what we have to do in policy work. But I think the fact that people can learn from deliberation processes is a really important thing, because they go away and I think have far better understandings of what's going on in the world than they would otherwise. So that for me is an important aspect as well, right? Be exposed to the range of values and take that lesson away that you're not always going to get what you want. In fact, you don't even know what you want half the time.
I ask this next question because you are so steeped in the literature, you've seen models. Might be an unfair question, right? But maybe also imaginative, because you're also dabbled in, you're also an expert in futures thinking as well. You've described to us community governance models that have worked or that have shown potential, right? In Singapore, national conversations. In Australia, you have the citizen juries. In the US, a lot of the citizen-based transformation work, right? What do you think is the potential of community-based governance? Or rather, a broader way of asking the question is, what's not been done yet that you think can be done? Like, you're itching for something like that to happen that you think will really galvanize this process of helping folks learn, helping folks build muscles, helping communities really find the ability and potential or maximize the potential to be involved in governance in that sense.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, let me tell you what I think should not be done, right? Because I don't think every issue is amenable to consultation. I would not consult on things like taxation. Because what's going to happen, right? You ask people, how much tax do you want to pay? And they're like, nothing, right? And that's just not useful to anybody, right? So I don't think that's actually helpful to anyone. And something should be decided by the power of the state. Of course, you want to make sure that it's a benign state and a state that is accountable and responsible, all of that, right? Not kleptocratic, not rent-seeking. All of that needs to be true. But ultimately, a functional state needs to make those decisions. It's not about asking the citizens, because you just end up with more problems at that point. What I would love to see, to be honest, is systems whereby traditional party-based parliaments continue to exist, because you know, they do serve an important function. But I would also love to see, not quite sortition, but a system whereby we also have consultative assemblies of randomly selected citizens.
Yeah.
And this is not a Senate, right? It's not about upper or lower house. It's just a parallel house. And for these people, what I think would be really interesting is if a system says, all right, we want to appoint you because we know that your perspectives are going to be valuable in the policy process. But we also want to make sure that you are well informed about this. So the way I would design this would be to start by saying, 2 years in advance, we run this random lottery, right? And we really aim for as much diversity as possible, right? So it's not just about expertise, right? You have an equal chance of coming in, whether you're a McKinsey consultant or a farmer or someone who works in a market or someone who drives a cab or a Grab, whatever, right? We want everybody or as many people as possible to be there. You can't have everyone, right? But you can have a pretty decent representative sample, right? So I would recruit for representativeness. And then, because it's 2 years in advance, I would tell people so that they know that they're going to need to spend some time on this, right? So if you're a university lecturer, please don't go and arrange to teach like five different classes during that period, right? Because I've told you in advance that this is your, it's like jury duty, right? You turn up, right? Except it might be a bit longer in this case. So that's one aspect. But then I would also see if there can be a certain amount of public funds that we assign to the group to say, all right, each of you gets X thousand dollars. Not huge, but a certain amount of money, whereby you decide what you want to be, right, in this consultative assembly. And then you go and spend 2 years learning. It's going to sound dreadfully idealistic, right, in some ways. But I'm happy to admit that I'm an idealist, right? I really want to think about how systems can function at their best, not just minimizing for their worst problems. And I think this could be really powerful because, first of all, these people are going to go and learn.
Yeah.
And they're going to come and provide really interesting perspectives to the process. They need to be facilitated, of course, right? So there has to be a sense of what the ground rules are in these discussions and all of that. But I think you could get some real insights coming out of it. And then, because if you then change this group every, say, 2 years, and you change maybe, or you change a third of the group once every 3 years, you're ending up with constant flux and fluidity, which will give you a whole really interesting sense of what overall citizen concerns are like. And I think even after the formal process of discussions and debates are done, these folks are going to go out and have really interesting things to say to their friends, their family, their relatives, partly about outcomes, but partly also to say, hey, you know, it's really hard to do this work. And that in itself is really powerful. We need more schooling, I think, in the complexity of how policy gets made. The National Day rally recently was interesting, I thought. When I heard PM talking about housing, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing I took away most was not just the outcomes of what the new scheme was going to look like, right? This new tiering that exists in housing prices, but the fact that he kind of took the country through a tutorial about how hard it is to make housing policy. It was a tutorial, right? And it was saying, it is hard. We have three aims and you can't achieve all three aims at the same time. So here's how we're managing it. And that learning value is so powerful because it helps people mature as a citizenry.
Yeah.
And I think something like a randomly selected consultative assembly could be really powerful. I don't think it should replace parliament. I'm happy for parliaments to continue to exist because, like I said, their purpose is different. And a consultative assembly probably should not be a lawmaking body, but it can have input into lawmaking.
Yeah.
And I think you end up with a richer set of perspectives that way. Does it take resources? Yes. Could it be somewhat costly? Absolutely. Can you do this in a system that doesn't have its fundamentals? No, right? You got to get things like fiscal resources. You got to get non-corruption, overall security and stability. All that needs to be sorted out first. But once those things are in place in countries like Singapore, the Netherlands, Canada, New Zealand, I think we could try these things out and it would be so interesting.
No, I think you answered basically my next question, right? Because one of the points you raised, and I think one of the perennial challenges of doing work that involves participatory forms, community-based forms of governance, it's always about representation and involvement, right? Because that was the point you mentioned. And I think what's lost in that conversation or consideration sometimes is folks who are more likely to be involved in things like the citizen jury, like the national conversations, don't look like the average citizen, right? There's a selection bias there going on. Yes, it's not as non-representative as maybe politicians and policymakers, right? But the makeup of these sometimes can mirror those of the public service agencies as well. But what I think you got to, and I completely agree, is not so much about the modality of it, but a process that involves some degree of randomness, also some degree of compulsion and facilitation, right? And when I think about that, I'm like, in Singapore, CIP, VIA feels like a missed opportunity, right? Because we force folks through a system where they have to do community service, right? And volunteerism. But having gone through it and having done some studies of it as well, it seems and feels like a missed opportunity because it's not often done well. Whether the modality takes the form or something like that doesn't really matter. But I think some degree of randomness where everyone has a chance to be involved. Compulsion where if you're selected, you can't have to do it to experience it. And then facilitation, which is someone coming in, guiding you through that process and not kind of throwing you out in the deep end, right? And some degree of combination of that seems like going to be really helpful. Yeah.
I would love to run something like that. I think it would be so much fun, first of all.
Yeah.
And then really useful, potentially.
So I'm also curious to know, because you're talking about different tools or different ways to facilitate community-based governance. So one thing we haven't really talked about is also other digital forms of public squares like Twitter or Facebook. And I'm curious to know whether you think Twitter and Facebook and the fact that enables some level of anonymity, right? That someone's just sitting behind a keyboard and they can type whatever they want. And to some extent, to a great deal of extent, they don't get held accountable to that. Do you think that encourages or that hinders the process of community-based governance?
Yeah, no, it's such an important question. I think for this one, I go back to what I said earlier, right, about both the transformative potential, but also the entrenchment potential that different technologies have. I think there was an expectation that there would be a creation of an online public square, right, through things like Facebook, Twitter. There was this declaration of independence of the internet, right, made around the 1990s, highly visionary in terms of the kinds of new opportunities that would come from the radical freedom and untrammeledness of this system. I think what's actually much more likely, though, is what I described, the kind of reinforcement hypothesis, because that's what you're going to end up seeing, even on entities like Twitter, where you have trolls get enabled, where you have inclinations for much more representative discussions, that's what will end up happening. That would be my brief answer to that question, because I think that's exactly what we've ended up seeing empirically.
And do you feel like the Web3 platforms bring anything significantly different as compared to the other kind of Web2 platforms?
I think the biggest thing that Web3 can do is it's about deep immersion, right? I mean, there are some skeptics who will say Web3 is really AR and VR done more systematically, allowing therefore for more immersiveness than before, right? I have to say, at the moment, I'm not sure the Web3 tech is developed enough to truly simulate real-time interaction. So I think Web3 is probably useful to reinforce pre-existing relationships, but I wouldn't use it to create new relationships. And what I mean by that is, if I'm designing a process of citizen engagement, right, I wouldn't put all of it in Web3. We just can't do that yet. You will end up with a really stilted and potentially quite stunted discussion as well. But I would be okay to say, all right, we're going to meet for 4 Saturdays or over a period of a month or two or whatever. But in between, we've created this Web3 platform where you guys can all have an avatar, you can interact with each other, but I would use it to therefore complement and augment the in-person rather than replace it entirely. But ask me again in a year as the technology improves, who knows what will happen at that point.
Yeah, I think the hard part with technology is that something can come out of left field and it completely changes the way we interact, and there's no way to see that. And it's funny because the premise of this series of podcasts is the future of. So on some level, we are a little bit crystal ball gazing, but it's almost always a projection of like our current status and our current, like what we see in the world today. So, you know, I always find these like conversations really interesting because part of it is that it's a recognition that we don't know. We just don't know. But at the same time, we need to act. We still need to make decisions. We still need to try and build the world that we think is better, even in the context of just not knowing.
Yes. And I think one key on this, right, is, you know, there's a lot of literature out there about how some systems exploit and other systems explore. You come across this before. There are exploratory learning systems, right, where you just say, all right, let's just do stuff without a sense of what outcomes we would like because we don't know. And so we just keep learning, right? And we try, we experiment, and we get data from the universe in response. An exploitation aim would be to say, I have a very specific idea of what I want. I want to optimize for A, B, and C, and that's what I'm going to try and do. And I think what's really interesting about community-based governance, right, is precisely because it is used to answer questions, but we don't know what the answers always are, right? Or we're trying to explore. It is invariably much more an exploration process than it is an exploitation process. And that in itself, I think, is useful because it's handy for us humans to realize that not everything can be pre-decided, preset, engineered, and then optimized. Sometimes it's good to say, actually, I don't know what the answer is. And that's why I'm having this discussion. And then as we discover together what's going on, then we might be able to make better decisions about what to exploit in the future. But we may not need to do that all from the outset.
So I think we're running a little bit over time. So I just kind of want to wrap up with something that's a little bit more personal. So, you know, this is one of the questions that we like to ask all our interviewees, which is that if you were to tell something to yourself 10 years ago, what would it be? Like, how have you changed from like where you were 10 years ago, and what would you want the former self 10 years ago to know?
It's interesting because 10 years ago was roughly when we were still at the beginning stages of the Singapore conversation, right? Designing it, wondering how much it would take root in the rest of government and in the rest of Singapore, actually, because this is not just a government thing, right? The Singapore conversation is literally a national conversation. And I think if I could go back, I would tell myself, don't give up, right? Keep at this, because what looks like a very lonely process now that isn't really taking root is actually going to have so much legs later on, right? More agencies are going to come on board. Everybody's going to learn how to use flip charts and Mr. Sketch markers and post-its better than you than anything we would have imagined at the time. Such that it became a, you know, it would actually became a point of vocabulary. People would start to say things like, I want to do an OSC style engagement. So you know, therefore, they're learning to differentiate that from traditional ways in which citizen engagement was done, right? With a whiteboard and a town hall type. Some people on the stage and some people off the stage. OSC was a much more participative, interactive sort of process. Yeah, so I would remind myself, take heart on that, because the world is changing. And I've reminded myself that I was going to meet lots and lots of allies along the way, which I have. Some of the examples I've mentioned in earlier on, right? All of them involve friends, you know, who are doing similar work. And I think when you're in for something with like-minded people who share that common mission, right, suddenly the process becomes a lot less lonely.
Thank you, Aaron. I mean, I speak for Sam as well. I mean, it feels that we barely scratched the surface, but that's always the sign of a really great conversation. You've given us so much food for thought. I have notes written down and I'm thinking and processing, and this has been really fun. And thank you again for coming back and joining us today.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.